Lecture 14. Herodotus Invents History.
Welcome back. If it were possible for us to get in a time machine and go back to the golden age of Athens, of Pericles and the other great leaders, back in the middle of the 5th century BC, we would have a chance to encounter some of the most remarkable thinkers and creative artists in all of human history. There at the Theater of Dionysus, we would have been able to hear plays written by the likes of Sophocles and Euripides in tragedy, and of Aristophanes in comedy. We would have been able to talk over military matters with Pericles himself or with Thucydides, who both led the Athenian fleet and then later on wrote a military history of the Peloponnesian War. We would have been able to meet philosophers like Socrates or Anaxagoras, the man who tried to replace a religious explanation of miracles with an understanding of the scientific principles of nature. We would have met great artists like Phidias. But if I could have a chance to pick the person I would most like to meet in that golden age world, it wouldn't be an Athenian. And we have to remember that Athens was a magnet for people from all over this new empire. And I should mention one more, Hippocrates from the island of Kos, the man who is given the credit for inventing modern style medicine, is a citizen of the Athenian Empire, is a man whose home island is part of that Delian League and then later Athens and its tribute-giving allies. But the man I would really like to meet is Herodotus. Herodotus of Halicarnassus, at the end of his life, having emigrated to a new Athenian colony in Italy, or a pan-Hellenic colony founded by Athens, Herodotus of Thurii, but just Herodotus. His name means the gift of Hera, and he was certainly a gift of a divine force to the human race. He had the good fortune to be born just as the Persian Wars were getting underway. He was probably 4 or 5 years old when the queen of his city, Artemisia, queen of Halicarnassus, went off to fight at Salamis for Xerxes and came home entrusted with the task of bringing Xerxes' sons back to Asia from the debacle in Europe. This was his city, this was his queen. As he grew up hearing the stories of that great expedition, that great battle at Salamis, from eyewitnesses, people in his city who had actually participated in the battle. He grew up a Greek within the Asiatic world. He was actually governed by Persian overlords when he was born. So he was a man who could see both sides of this great war, could interview people on both sides. He felt, to use a modern term, that the generation that fought in that war, both on the Persian side and the Greek side, was the greatest generation. And he made it his life's work to interview as many of them as he could, to travel to all of the places that had been involved in this conflict, and to create a work that would capture for all time in the memories of the people who actually lived through that war, what it had been like. I would like to give you his own preamble to that book that he wrote. Herodotus of Halicarnassus here sets forth his historiae. We'll come back to that word in a moment. So that mortal achievements may not become forgotten with the passage of time. So that great and marvelous deeds, some by Greeks, some by barbarians, meaning the Persians, may not be without their glory, and especially to show why the two peoples fought with one another. Greeks on the one side, Persians on the other. Now that word historiae has become our word history. To a Greek, it meant inquiry, research. It comes from a Greek root that actually means tracking things down. So it was all about the process of finding out the truth, finding out stories of what had happened in the past, and assembling them together. It became our word history, meaning the past and the study of the past, because Herodotus used it. He is the man who Cicero dubbed the father of history. And that's the title he's kept ever since, except by those people who are so disturbed by Herodotus' credulity and the fact that he believed, or at least put into his great work a lot of patently nonsensical stories from his informants. They call him the father of lies. Nonetheless, he was a very honest man by his own lights. He said at one point, after a particularly strange tale that he recorded, "This is what I was told. I don't believe it myself, but then it is my job to put down what those who saw these actions happen tell me. It's not my job to believe it." So he presents us with a very modern view of history as a gathering together of the memories of many different people who were involved in these great events and a recording of them for posterity, letting us know in most cases who told him what. What were his sources? Did he do the kind of documentary historical study and research we would have expected of a modern historian? Did he get into the old records and inscriptions and try to figure out the Athenian financial outlay for the war and things like that? No. In many cases, those documents were not present to him. And it's a funny thing that the Greeks were rather skeptical of inscribed pronouncements and so on, feeling that apparently those often had a lot of spin or government-based and biased attitude built into them. They liked what Herodotus did, that he went around and talked to people. And he often will give two and three different and contradictory versions of the same event. And this is why we credit him as the creator of this field of history. Before his time, there was chronicle. There was the idea of setting down in chronological order the facts of a period. But the idea of amassing what people remembered, the idea of tying it together with overarching themes like the conflict between East and West, and above all, the honesty of displaying biases and weighing evidence, this is the special achievement of Herodotus. He was inspired to create this first great work of history by the Greek and Persian wars. That conflict seemed to him so epic as to be worthy of a treatment on the scale of Homer's Iliad and Odyssey. And he certainly regarded the giant figures like Xerxes and Artemisia and Themistocles as worthy to stand beside Homer's heroes in the pantheon of human greats. Well, Herodotus had an interesting life himself. He became politically undesirable in his home city of Halicarnassus due to infighting, and he became a sort of exile. It's interesting to me to consider how many of the great ancient historians were exiles from their native towns. Herodotus from Halicarnassus, Thucydides, historian of the Peloponnesian War, from Athens, Polybius, the chronicler of the Roman Punic Wars, from his home, and Josephus, who chronicled the Jewish War against Rome, an exile from Judea and now an adopted Roman himself. There seems to be something about crossing over from your own birthplace into another world that helps people get the perspective and the motivation for creating what we now call history. Now, if you'd been in Athens, let's go back to our time machine. Set the dial for sometime in the 440s BC. You've gotten out of the time machine. You are in Athens. You're in the agora, that open space. That's all that agora means, which was the market and the civic center for the city of Athens. It was also a place to go and hear philosophers like Socrates talking and interrogating young men of Athens about their beliefs and their ideas. It was a place to hear people from outside Athens come and give sort of public lectures. You could hear authorities on military tactics talking. You could hear scientists explaining marvels. And you could hear Herodotus. Herodotus, having traveled the Greek world and beyond, and we'll talk about his travels in a moment, went to cities like Athens or places like the Olympic Games at Olympia, wherever there'd be a big crowd, and he'd stand up on some sort of pedestal and he would just talk. And part of the charm of this incredible book that he created is it sounds as if he's there talking to you. It's a very conversational style and a very beautiful Ionic-influenced Greek. And as he rambles from story to story, as his mind is prompted by telling one tale to think of another and go straight on to it, regardless of chronology, one can feel one is lost in a labyrinth of the reminiscences of the brain who, more than any other in human history, was stocked with an entire world of stories, memories, myths, geographical observations, sights that he had seen, people that he had talked to. This is the world of Herodotus, and he would stand there in front of these crowds of people and tell his stories. People remembered them. People loved them. They were exciting. He had Thermopylae and Leonidas in the pass. He had Xerxes sitting on his throne above Salamis. He had Miltiades on the field at Marathon. He went all the way back into the origins of the whole conflict with the kingdom of Lydia, the dynasty of King Croesus, the invasion of Cyrus. All of this was in there. He was a very pious man. He believed that history was the working out of divine purpose and destiny here on earth. And so he spent a lot of time on oracles. And it's important he did that for us because they certainly shaped the events of these peoples who believe very fervently in what they received as messages from the gods through the oracles. So he's a typical man of his time, and his attitudes and the things he held important help us see that time as it was perceived by the people who lived then. But in many ways, he is not a typical man of his time. As he stood there addressing those Greeks who had come to listen to his stories, he would often be presenting the Persians in a strikingly favorable light. He did not demonize peoples. He seems to me to be the most tolerant, open-minded intellect that ever lived on this earth. And certainly his view of the world was one that most of his listeners could only hope to share. A man who had seen many strange peoples, visited many distant places, and had been interested in all of them. Certainly there's never been anyone less judgmental than Herodotus was. The Athenians were deeply impressed by his recitals. He came to love Athens as a second home. If it hadn't been for those citizenship laws, he probably would have liked to have been adopted as an Athenian citizen. He did the next best thing. Athens had founded a Panhellenic colony in southern Italy, a city at Thurii, sort of founded under Athenian auspices, and he joined the parade of remarkable people who went out there and joined that new colonial venture. At that point, he became Herodotus of Thurii. But he admired the Athenians in return for the good impression they had of him. And he wanted to remind the other Greeks, who by his day were regarding Athens with suspicion, dislike, and resentment, that Greece owed its freedom to Athens. That if the Athenians had not made the sacrifice, the financial sacrifice to create their fleet, if they had not stayed in Greek waters and fought for the rest of Greece after their own city had been taken, Greece would have fallen. He said at one point, "I shall say something that I know will not be popular. It is the Athenians to whom we truly owe the Greek victory in the Persian Wars. If they had gone away and left the rest of Greece to its own defense, what would have prevented the navy of the great king from landing wherever it wished and taking the Peloponnese as well as northern and central Greece?" This view of the Athenians was so pleasing to those people that they gave him a big financial gift in the course of his life. And we have to remember this is how itinerant people like Herodotus would live. No doubt he had private means, but it must have been a very pleasing thing that cities would offer him awards of gold and silver for coming and entertaining them with his wonderful stories. Now, he eventually, of course, let's talk a little bit about how a book is created in the ancient world. There is often an oral element to the things. Our books of the plays of Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides, Aristophanes, those are scripts of what was originally spoken on a stage. Homer's Iliad and Odyssey were originally oral recitations. Sagas committed to memory by bards and recited at feasts and ultimately written down. Well, we certainly get that feeling with Herodotus, especially the way he will put in little asides or think forward to what he's going to say next or hark back to an earlier story he's already told or fit something in by saying, "Oh, I forgot to say," and then tuck it in there. We almost get a picture of him standing and reciting while a scribe quickly notes down all these stories. That would have been the original text, probably not written by hand by Herodotus himself, but recited by him and written down by a scribe. It's being written down on scrolls of papyrus. Those scrolls will then be fixed up and edited by Herodotus with little notes in the margin to correct them or add things that he thought of at the last minute. And then, to create the book, some reader will stand in the middle of a room filled with scribes, each one with their own papyrus scroll, and read the histories of Herodotus in a slow, clear voice, and all of those people will be making a copy of their own, which can be distributed and sold. There are certain things that make it difficult for us to know exactly what the original text was. Sometimes they would mishear things. And so we will get, in different copies, variant readings or interpretations. Sometimes they would not hear a sentence at all, and we'll have a lacuna, as it's called, a vacancy in one of the manuscripts. And the Greek practice of not leaving spaces between words and not putting in all the accent marks of later Greek makes it sometimes ambiguous exactly what these people would have said. And certainly, Herodotus's love of foreign names and foreign terms must have been a great puzzlement to Greek scribes sitting there and trying to commit to paper something they were hearing recited in the room. Nonetheless, these copies would then be the source of future copies, and they would be taken in bundles of scrolls down to the marketplace and sold. The size of the book determined the number of scrolls. Herodotus's histories were so vast, it took 9 papyrus scrolls in order to make the whole thing. This is what they called the books of Herodotus. And because there were 9, they thought of the 9 muses, those goddesses of inspiration. And the early copies of Herodotus had the name of a muse. Cleo, for instance, was the muse of history, as the title of each of the 9 books of Herodotus's history. He began with the statement you've just heard, and then plunged right into things like the Trojan War and Jason and the Argonauts' expedition to the Black Sea as predecessors of the Greek and Persian conflict. He ended with the scene of the Athenians and the Ionians capturing the city of Sestos in the Hellespont, capturing the cables of Xerxes' bridges, and carrying them home to be trophies in the year 479 BC. But he didn't want to end there. Where did he really want to end? He wanted to end with a moral lesson. Herodotus had the view, unfashionable today in some circles, that history is meant to teach you things, and that history is meant to teach you moral things, not just facts, but important things about choices you make and how you lead your life. This is one reason people turn, still today, 2,500 years later, to the pages of Herodotus, not just for entertainment of the great stories, not just for education about the facts of the Greek and Persian wars, but for that spiritual refreshment of a man who felt deeply on so many matters and wanted his book to be the carrier of these ideas to the future. So Herodotus ended by harking back to the hero from the first pages of his story, the Persian conqueror Cyrus, who rose from obscurity to lead his people to world empire. And that story that Cyrus had challenged the Persians when they told him they wanted to move down on the plains and have a beautiful life enjoying the fruits of empire. You'll remember he challenged them and said, I'm not sure you really want this. Rough countries breed tough men. Soft countries, the reverse. Do you want to be rough and rule, or do you want to live soft and be ruled by others? And as you'll remember, they agreed with him, and that's why he built his capital up in the highlands of the Persian homeland. That is where Herodotus chose to end this epic work, with Cyrus talking to the other Persians about what these choices mean. And it's fascinating also that this ties together Herodotus's themes of geography and history. Time and time again, he attributes national characteristics of people to the kind of world, the kind of natural world in which they live. How could he do this? It's because he was probably one of the most widely traveled people in all of the ancient world. From his original home in Halicarnassus, he moved to the offshore island of Samos. He lived there for a number of years, and then he embarked on travels. We know he traveled widely through Greece. We know that he went up into the Black Sea and actually visited places like the Crimea and the area around the mouths of the Danube and possibly even the far eastern end of the Black Sea, where Jason went to seek the legendary Golden Fleece. He met people who knew the Scythians, those Indo-European horse lords who ruled the vast steppes of Eurasia. He saw the grain trade and the trade in salt fish, the trade in slaves. He saw the makers of gold who lived up there, the makers of gold artifacts who lived up there in Scythia. He was fascinated by people the more different they were from him. And so he recorded in great detail the Scythian traditions. He may have seen the funeral of a Scythian king. He saw the ceremonies of the horsemen for their king. He saw the erection of the great burial mound with the king interred inside with his treasures. And archaeology in the 19th and 20th century has recovered some of those same mounds that Herodotus saw and brought to light again the treasures of the Scythian kings. He was fascinated by anything that was out of the ordinary for the Greeks, the long midsummer days of northern latitudes, the snowfall in the north, which was such a rare thing in the Greek world, and he brought all these stories back out of the Black Sea. Some people think he may have been a merchant because he's always interested in what is bought and sold. I don't know if that's really true, that means he was a merchant. There are people who think Shakespeare was a doctor or a lawyer or a merchant himself because he shows such expertise and the knowledge of the jargon of all those trades, and Herodotus is a bit like that. At any rate, one of his interests in the Black Sea stems from the fact that after the Athenians captured the Hellespont and the approaches to the Black Sea in their sort of counterattacks on Persia at the end of the Persian Wars, they became masters of the waterway that brought the wealth of the Black Sea into the Mediterranean, and that was the route where most of the Mediterranean's wheat, or at least the eastern Mediterranean's wheat, was coming from. It was grown on the vast plains of the Ukraine and southern Russia. The Scythians would then send it down the rivers to the Crimea and the ports there, many of which were now Greek colonies. It was loaded onto gigantic wooden ships, grain freighters, and carried across the Black Sea, down through the Hellespont, and most of it ended up going to the Piraeus, the new center of Mediterranean trade, now that Athens is the center of sea power in the Mediterranean. Herodotus knew all that. He was traveling on the routes that this global market was using to convey these commodities from the ends of the earth to the great cities of the Mediterranean. He respected and admired another seafaring people, people on the Persian side of the divide, and those were the Phoenicians. We wouldn't know very much about the Phoenicians if it weren't for Herodotus, because they didn't write a great deal themselves, or at least their writings have not survived. I want to give you an example of something that we owe to Herodotus that at the same time shows us his mind at work. Take two things from his Phoenician stories. He tells us that about 200 years before his own time, the Phoenicians sailed around Africa, circumnavigated the entire continent. Now, this is two millennia before Vasco da Gama, the Portuguese explorer who gets credit in modern books for circumnavigating Africa and being the first. This is two millennia before his voyage in the 1490s. Here are these Phoenicians making the same voyage all the way back in those early days before the Persian Wars. How did they do it? Herodotus gives us the story. He says there was a pharaoh of Egypt who wanted to know the limits of Africa and wanted to know if it were truly a landmass that could be circumnavigated. So he had a Phoenician fleet under his sponsorship start in the Red Sea, sail southward down the coast of Africa till they got to the tip, around that point, and come back in through the Pillars of Hercules or Heracles at the mouth of the Mediterranean, and then return to Egypt and the delta of the Nile River by that way. He tells us that it took them 3 years to do it. He tells us that they ran out of food several times, went ashore, planted crops, waited for the crops to grow in the warm African sun, and then with a new harvest set off again. And he also tells us he doesn't believe the story. And here is why Herodotus is such an incredibly valuable historical source. Here is why we treasure so much his attitude toward his sources. He didn't believe this story. If he'd been a Thucydides, he never would have put it in. Thucydides looked at the evidence. Anything he didn't believe, he excluded rigorously. His account was the one true account that he had determined to be factual. Herodotus puts it all in. But the fact is, the element that he found cause for disbelief is the very point that proves to us the Phoenicians really did it. Herodotus tells us that when they got to the southern tip of Africa, those seagoing Phoenicians, they were headed west to get around what we would call the Cape of Good Hope. And as they did so, they found miraculously that the sun in the heavens at midday was on their right hand. Now, if you're facing west and something is on your right hand, it's to the north. He's always interested in geography. Well, in European terms, that's impossible. The sun is always to the south. Herodotus had a circular idea of the world, but not a spherical idea. He didn't understand that at the equator, everything changes. The constellations turn on their heads, and the sun will be found to your north in the sky, not as it was in Greece, throughout the Mediterranean, throughout the whole world that he knew, always to the south. And he said, well, this is obviously an impossibility. So the whole story must be false. So his incredulity and his desire to explain why they're wrong has given us the information that proves they actually did it. The coast of Africa is, for the most part, north-south, all the way down that coast of the Indian Ocean. It's not till you get to the southern part by the Cape of Good Hope and swing around to the west, headed for the Atlantic, that you would have the sun on your right hand. Very clear evidence for us that the Phoenicians really made it. There's one beautiful passage from Herodotus. Let's have another. He was interested in Phoenician trading. I told you he's interested in the world's merchandising and mercantile life. And he knew that the Phoenicians and their friends, the Carthaginians, friends, they're actually colonists of Phoenicians who settled down in what is today modern Tunis, they would go out of the Pillars of Heracles into the Atlantic and down the African coast, and they would be going after gold and ivory and ebony and the other treasures of Africa. Well, he describes the most charming form of exchange that's ever been committed to paper. The Phoenicians would go to a place where there was a small offshore island. They would gather their ships there and then put together the things that they wanted to trade with the Africans at that point on the coast. And they were probably cloths and manufactured goods from the Mediterranean, perhaps metalwork also. So they would cross over to the shore of the mainland and they would lay out on the beach everything that they wanted to trade. And then they'd go back to their island and they'd wait. Onto the beach would then come the local people who would walk around and look over the piles of Phoenician goods laid out for their inspection. They would then go back to their homes and they would bring out a certain quantity of ivory and gold and other local products. And then they'd go away. The Phoenicians would now come back, look over the piles, and if they didn't think it was enough, they'd go back to the island. More would be brought out. The process was repeated until both sides were happy. The Africans that they had given as much as they felt they could for what was there, the Phoenicians that they were receiving as much as was right for the goods that they had brought. And so, with mutual respect, no possibility of hostilities, the two sides parted, each taking away the goods that the other had brought, each happy that they had come out well from the bargain. This sort of silent trade is almost unique in the history of the world's markets, and I'm sure there would have been a lot less heartache over the economic expansions of Europe in the Renaissance if the same kind of respect for the people they were coming in contact with had been shown. Herodotus obviously loved this story, and I think it symbolized for him the way people should treat each other. Try to avoid, if at all possible, anything that will lead to strife, to conflict, to violence. Respect others. Treat others as you would want to be respected. He did the same kind of exploration in Egypt. He went up the Nile River. He saw Elephantine, that cataract of the Nile near the Aswan Dam where the ivory of Africa was brought. That's why it was called Elephantine. He went to southern Italy, of course, when he moved there, and he would describe for his Italian listeners things around the globe that are given in sort of terms of what an Italian would be able to picture, because his audience is shifting from the Athenians early on to the Italians in the later book, now that he's become an Italian himself. And he traveled through the Persian Empire. The greatest loss is that somewhere along the line, there was a scroll, there was a 10th book, apparently, that would have been what he called Assyrian stories, that is Mesopotamian history. He did a whole book on the history of Egypt and its monuments. He did the same thing, apparently, for Nineveh, for Babylon, for Assyria and Mesopotamia. Those are lost. But he gives a wonderful description of the towering walls of Babylon, the amazing irrigation, ditches, the hanging gardens. It's all there in Herodotus to charm the mind, to awaken the spirit of inquiry and interest in all of his listeners and in all of his readers. So in this way, Herodotus gave to the Greek world a picture of its great setting, where the Greeks fit into the world at large, a history of their greatest and proudest hours, those moments of victory over the Persian invaders. But he gave them something else. He gave them a vision to live up to, a vision of harmony between peoples, who not only respect themselves, but respect others. And at the same time, he reminded the Athenians and Spartans of his own day that there had been a time that they lived at peace. There had been a time when they accomplished great things because they worked together in unity and harmony. And it was Herodotus' dream that those times could come again.